Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Wisdom of Your Body, Finding Healing, Wholeness, and Connection Through Embodied Living by Hilary L. McBride, Ph.D. Narrated by Emily Ellett. An Invitation to Begin. I have a childhood memory that shimmers. It is late summer and I am out riding bikes with my best friend. We are pedaling as fast as we can down a long stretch of even pavement, with ditches on either side that separate the road from the surrounding farmland. To our right, a heron. It stands there, immobile and patient, the picture of waiting. To our left, rows of raspberry bushes go on until they dissolve into the horizon. The sun is sinking, and as instructed, we will soon be home for dinner. Something cooking on the grill, new potato salad, and the front door open to keep the air moving through the house. But until then, we rule the road, sweat and summer sun on sticky necks, part laughing, part squealing with delight, panting breaths as we pedal hard and fast. In this moment, with my bodily senses turned all the way up, I am totally alive. When I think about being human, the fragile, precious, and mysterious journey we each take from birth to death, I think about the body. The body is the place where all of this happens. We know that when we are young. As babies, we reach out to touch our own feet or stare at the face of a parent, and we know how to take it all in. We learn to walk and then to run, realizing our bodies can take us somewhere fast, and create an instant game of chase with someone who loves us. We learn to use one part of our body to care for another part of our body. A hand holds a toothbrush to clean our mouths, wields a hairbrush to arrange the hair on our head, or rubs soap into our skin under running water. We learn our bodies can shape the world around us as we jump in puddles and feel we are all powerful. The delight of it all moves up and out through our lips as we giggle and laugh, telling the world around us through waves of sound that our body knows joy. All of that happens through the mystery of being a body. Yet so many of us have forgotten about this mystery. For some of us, that forgetting is intentional and swift. We notice things that feel distracting, overwhelming, or inconvenient, and we want them to stop. Or someone else tells us that the knowing knot of fear in the pit of our stomach is wrong and we need to make it go away. For others, the forgetting happens slowly over time. It accumulates in receiving disapproving looks from others, sitting still in long work or school meetings, being told to put mind over matter, or pushing the novelty and mystery of physical sensation into the furthest corners of our awareness. Or we have a defining experience where the bottom drops out and the voices in our head make pronouncements. Your body is bad. Or your body made this happen. Or you cannot trust yourself. So we make silent vows to lock away the dangerous parts of us and label them not me. No matter how or why we get there, no matter how well it may have served us, forgetting the body also costs us something, individually and collectively. We lose the fundamental building blocks of human thriving, connection to ourselves and others, and the fullness of pleasure, wisdom, empathy, and justice. Connection to our bodily selves allows us to internalize a sense of safety and connection that tells us who we are, what we long for, and how to be most fully alive. If each one of us is a body, then the body is the constant invitation to see ourselves as connected to each other. The person you come to see as your hero or your enemy took a breath right now, just as you did. Regardless of our circumstances or what we have been told about bodies, remembering and reuniting with our bodily selves is a radical act to undo our need to earn our worth, helping us wake up to the fact that there is something sacred right here, in this moment, always present and always available. That connection to our bodily selves is available to us in every moment, We have always been embodied, but sometimes we need a gentle invitation to remember that. We need to encounter our physicality and to know that this breath, these hands, these lungs and eyes and cerebrospinal fluid, this body is good. Consider this your invitation. Some of what you hear in this book might feel familiar in a bodily way, as if I am putting words to things you already know. Or it might seem disorienting or incongruent with ideas you have held or have been instructed to hold. I invite you to be curious, to see every reaction as a doorway to knowing yourself better. Know that your body will be communicating, sending messages, like a quickened heartbeat, a jolt of tension, a long exhale. Please listen. These sensations are initiating a conversation with your thinking brain. Allow yourself to be curious about what that communication might mean for you or what it tells you about your past. This thoughtful engagement with bodily sensation is a form of integration essential for wholeness and healing. Then keep the conversation going by talking to others. The end of each chapter includes some things to think about and some things to try. Use these prompts to take the content and put it into conversational spaces. Whether you have a formal discussion in a book club or a casual one with a friend, please talk with people in your life about what you hear in this book, making the choice to share more vulnerable things with the trustworthy people. Just by doing so, you are inviting the people around you into more awareness, integrating your own learning more deeply, and changing how we talk about bodies culturally. As you will learn throughout the book, doing so is good for our individual well-being and the health of our community. A note on the stories in this book. All the stories are real, but sometimes the names have been changed at the request of the person whose story is being told. When using an alias, I also changed or left out details to protect anonymity. I have also honored each person's choice of personal pronouns, which includes using the pronouns they, he, and or she. All stories are used with permission. This book speaks to issues predominant in a Western culture, a context that in different ways and at different times has both afforded me social power and restricted it because of my body. I am in an ongoing process of trying to better see the harmful ways I have been shaped by and perpetuated the dominant culture's problematic stories about bodies. Although the writing of a book must end, my personal learning will not, and for that I am grateful. I also anticipate that our collective thinking about the body from a biological, philosophical, and sociopolitical perspective will continue to develop. In the future, we will know more than we do now. I hope that knowing more will help us create a more just and loving world. In whatever ways you can, please take these ideas as a jumping-off point for you to keep learning, thinking, and experiencing yourself as a body in new, more connected, free, and compassionate ways. Teresa Silo, a professor of somatic psychology, has said, "The body is not a thing we have, but an experience we are." May this book be an invitation into an even deeper experience of who you are, and may you encounter that experience as sacred, connected, and loved. 1. Fully Alive, Exploring and Understanding Embodiment. I was 13 the first time I threw up on purpose. I hid in the back of a dark bathroom, just beyond the reach of a buzzing fluorescent light that hung above and to the left of the bathroom stall. I was there with my eating disorder, and together we were beginning what would be a very quick descent into an even darker place, the complete eradication of myself through the disappearance of my body. Physically, parts of my body would shrink away as I became small. My freedom to think about the world outside the narrow container of my fragile mind would evaporate. My voice, both my inner knowing and the vocal sound a body makes, and my ability to want or desire anything would vanish. Soon I would chip away the parts of myself I knew, like picking flecks of blistered paint off a wall, revealing what had once been there only by its absence. The room began to swirl as stars shot like fireworks across my vision. I slid down against the bathroom stall until I was half lying and half sitting. I tried to catch my breath as beads of moisture formed in protest across the back of my neck. The sensation, a voice begging me to stop. My body softly whispered the objection, "Why would you hurt me like this?" Choosing to be fully alive. That dark moment in a bathroom stall happened almost 20 years ago. Today, I am someone people consider an expert about how we relate to our bodies and what gets in the way of that. Although I have been doing this work for some time, through the academic perils of a master's degree, a PhD, and ongoing clinical training and research projects, I am far from having all the answers, as if that were a thing that could happen. But I am fascinated by the questions, struggles, and delights of what it means to be human, to be a body in this time and place. The deeper I dive, the clearer it becomes. Being fully connected to the body is about being fully alive. For some of us, the complexity and richness of being fully alive is difficult, and we struggle to consent to all it holds: loss, grief, pain, aloneness, illness, the pangs of hunger or fullness, the grip of fear, and the finality of death. In fact, we may even be trying to avoid feeling these things at all costs. But in the process, we also lose access to the beautiful things that come with being fully alive in our bodies: pleasure, joy, energy, connection, sensuality, self-expression, creativity, being held, and savoring the sun's warmth. We can't avoid the painful things we experience through our bodies without sacrificing the good, the beautiful, the rich. But we did not find our way to a disembodied existence on our own. We had centuries of help. Western philosophical influences like Gnosticism, the Greek thinker Plato, and later Descartes, whose theories influenced the development of the Enlightenment, all had a significant influence on widespread religious, philosophical, and cultural thought. They influenced a popular line of thinking that went something like this: the soul and the mind are distinct from the body. Although the church originally condemned Gnosticism as a heresy, the church was not, and still is not, immune to a Gnostic worldview, which, at its worst, suggested that matter was evil, the spirit and body were distinct, and we needed to escape this world to find salvation. Plato, Descartes, and Gnosticism suggested that the body has needs and limitations, but that truth exists in the mind. The goal is to leave the body, rising above it to find that our being now exists in a space not weighed down by the realness of flesh and blood and pain and death and desire. You might have even heard this idea as an encouragement from someone: mind over body, or as it's often said, mind over matter. Over time, this line of thinking became the foundation of our common discourse. Through our language and thought, we have carried on this disconnection. We say, "My body won't let me," or "I can't believe it won't," without realizing our language tells on us, revealing a problematic narrative woven into our cultural fabric. Still, none of it fully removes us from this essential truth. We are our bodies. The body is central to our experiences, to our sense of ourselves, to our autobiographical narratives. The body is the only way we have to move through life. Yet research about body dissatisfaction and body hatred shows us that the majority of us, up to 90% of those of us in Western culture and in communities touched by globalization, inclusive of women and men, loathe our bodies. Numbers this high and this pervasive among both men and women have led researchers to characterize the Western relationship with the body as normative discontent. So normal we can forget there is any other way to relate to our bodies, individually and culturally. We've been taught to see our bodies as objects, as appearances to evaluate. And we get frustrated that our bodies are different from what we've been told they should be. Not white enough, able enough, straight enough, male enough, old enough, young enough, thin enough, muscular enough, not ever quite enough. The list of not enoughs is endless and costly. It's a form of hand-me-down shame that robs us of time, money, opportunity, and energy. But ultimately, what body hatred costs us, individually and collectively, is the fullness of life. We lose out on the goodness that comes through our body. And if we are our body, we miss out on experiencing our own goodness and the presence and wisdom that comes from deep connection to ourselves. We also lose out on connection with others, the quality of touch offered to soothe a wound, kissing someone who makes our body feel electric, or celebrating how breasts can nourish and nurture a baby. There is so much goodness within and between us because of our bodies, the bodies we spend so much time trying to get away from, control, or blame. Becoming embodied. By the time I started seeing Liz, my therapist, I had been sick for a long time. She was my last-ditch effort for recovery from an eating disorder that was stubborn, life-threatening, and eroding all the most beautiful parts of my life. The experts had given all sorts of names to my behavior and the way I was feeling: bulimia nervosa, anorexia nervosa, OCD, depression, and anxiety to start. Those names quickly became my names, indistinguishable from my sense of self. It was several years after the first time I purged, and my family had tried everything they could to help me get well. But I wasn't really there for most of it. I was riding a pain escape merry-go-round and not reflecting much on it. Thinking back now, it seemed as though I did not exist anymore. In my place was a desperate, defensive, and hollow version of me, half a life. I believed that Liz really saw me. Unlike the medical experts who saw a set of symptoms or an eroding body, Liz saw me. She saw me as separate from the pathology of the eating disorder, that I was not it, in a way that I was not able to do for myself. She never once asked me what I weighed. We talked about the forces that shape how so many people feel about their bodies: existentialism, feminism, colonialization, the sociocultural framework, and more. We drummed together. She described the joy she felt in her soft, short, and round body as she was aging, and sometimes we watched TED Talks on her small office computer. She called me a philosopher queen, and when she looked me in the eye, her gaze said, "I know there is more to you than this." She cupped her hands around the remnant flame of spirit inside me, protecting the flickering light until it grew stronger, and then placed my own hands around the flame and made me the protector of this growing force. Unlike the early stages of the eating disorder, which felt like a toxic love affair with a violent and abusive lover who also sometimes brought me security and generous gifts, therapy felt like a slow climb out of a hellish pit of madness and darkness, so vast it was impossible to imagine any other way of being. I had been seeing Liz for about 3 years, and had just returned from my first trip to Europe. I felt a rush of excitement as I sat down in the corner chair. I couldn't wait to tell her about climbing a volcano in Greece, jumping off the front of a huge ship into the Mediterranean, and an adventurous train ride through Bavaria. I expected her to ask me more questions about my trip and about how my eating had been while I was away, but she didn't say much at all. When the conversation paused, she smiled, her eyes alive with spark and spice. "Do you notice how you're sitting in the chair today?" she asked. Silence. Once more.
Do you notice how you're sitting in the chair today?
Silence again. Her words reached my ears but didn't mean anything. I was unsure how to answer because, until this point in my adult life, I had never actually been aware of my body from the inside. I was a floating head. Most of the time, it seemed like nothing existed from my jawline down. If something bodily did exist, I only knew how to scrutinize it as if detached and from the outside.
Do you know how you used to sit when we first met?
She asked. I slowly shook my head. How did I sit when we first met?
You used to sit like this,
she said, and pulled her knees up to her chest, wrapped her arms around her legs, and rested her head on her knees with her gaze turned away. I saw her curled up in a ball, and for the first time saw myself from the outside. Seeing this normally unapologetic and fierce woman looking so small in the chair shifted something in me. I felt grief and compassion for the version of me who had to be so tucked away, who had tried so hard to disappear that she had literally taken up as little space as possible.
It is so good to see you taking up more space,
she said.
I can see from how you are sitting that your relationship with your body is healing. You're not hiding as much. What you do with your body says so much about what is happening inside of you and how it is to be you.
This conversation felt like a flipped switch, an epiphany. The only way to describe it is that my consciousness, my sense of myself as a person, was stuffed into my skull like a balloon pinched at my neck. The fingers of patriarchy, pain, avoidance, sorrow, and objectification were firm around my neck, the base of the balloon. Liz's question pried the fingers off the balloon, and my sense of self started flowing into all the parts of me. The awareness was sudden and all-encompassing. It moved down my neck and shoulders, into my arms and out to my fingertips. It filled my torso and pelvis and sit bones, and it poured down into my legs and ankles and feet. I became aware of how I was filling the chair, sitting cross-legged, palms open and resting on the arms of the chair, my chest open and my face up and looking squarely at her. For the first time in years, I was fully present, body and mind together in a lingering awareness that spread throughout my form. I also noticed something else. This awareness and presence felt right. It was rich and safe. How did I arrive here? I thought, full of wonder. All this happened in real time, in what for her was a few moments of silence, but for me felt eternal, as if I'd lived all the lifetimes ever lived in a single moment. Does my left foot always feel like it's going to fall asleep when it's tucked under the back of my right leg? Have I ever felt myself while sitting in a chair before, filling the chair, arms and fingers even draped over the sides? How is Liz sitting? Plump body also filling the chair, but differently, her knees bent with feet on the floor, shorter and sitting back, less upright than myself, more relaxed. Her demeanor is gentle but direct, like she's commanding a ship. And I got all of that just by looking at how she was sitting. The ways I had been protecting myself from pain were starting to fall away. I didn't need them anymore. I began to realize that I would always be my body, but the way I experienced my body could evolve, and that evolution could be deeply good. We all have moments in our lives when we realize how much has changed. We see a current photo next to a childhood photo and are struck by the transformation. This experience was like that, and it woke me up to a whole new dimension of existence. Suddenly, I was more in the room, more of myself than maybe I'd ever been, fully present with myself and with Liz. I left her office that day a different person. However, it wasn't until several years later that I found the name for what had happened that day. Embodiment. Understanding embodiment. There is no unified definition of embodiment, but we often hear of it when people are talking about a quality or idea being lived out. Someone will say that a leader embodies the style of leadership that they talk about. But here, I'm using the word to describe something broader than that, the experience of being a body in a social context. I began learning about embodiment through my research and clinical work with body image. I focused on eating disorder prevention, specifically what it looks like when women love their bodies. A big chunk of eating disorder prevention and body love work centers on body image, the idea that we hold in our minds an image of what our body looks like. And generally, we have feelings about that image. We evaluate our body based on what we've been told is good or not so good when it comes to that image. It's great to have a positive mental representation of the body, but this is not the same thing as embodiment. It's like finding a beautifully wrapped present on the table at a birthday celebration, but never opening the box to experience the wonderful something inside waiting to be enjoyed, received. I have sat with women, men, and non-binary folks who thought that changing their body image, specifically their thoughts about the body, would help them have a healthier relationship with the body. So they tried to beat a new perspective into their perception. It often sounded like this: if I just notice hurtful thoughts about my body and change them, then I'll feel better about myself. Or, every time I think I hate the way I look, I'll try to substitute it quickly with a positive thought. Then over time, that will become my new thought, right? Inevitably, they end up tired and frustrated. We might want our negative thoughts to disappear, but we can't get rid of them with thought substitution alone. After all, that does not identify where those thoughts come from in the first place. As proverbial wisdom reminds us, we cannot solve a problem with the same level of consciousness that created it. Thoughts are like blossoms on a flower. There's a stem, and then a whole root system beneath them. Thought substitution alone is like plucking off a dandelion bloom, glue gunning a daffodil blossom on the stem, and expecting daffodils to keep blooming. In this case, lasting change requires digging up the roots of one flower and planting a new bulb to grow the other. These new bulbs are embodied experiences. The soil is the context that supports our blooming. The neuroscience of healing has proven to be true time and time again. Change does not happen through trying to trick ourselves out of a story we have been groomed to rehearse through our developing years. Rather, transformation happens from the ground up, when we have a new experience of ourselves and hold our attention on it long enough for it to sink in. Learning embodiment, how to be in our bodies in a way that protects us from body shame, requires more than just thinking differently about our appearance. It requires curiosity, attention, sensation, and acceptance, which then allows us to develop a healthier and more stable relationship with our body as a whole. This relationship with our body includes our appearance, but also requires relearning how to experience the body from the inside out. Being in our body gives us access to all the wisdom that our bodies hold. This allows us to know ourselves more fully, experiencing ourselves as good and sacred, and hold safety within ourselves no matter what happens around us. Embodiment is a way to heal the mind-body divide we experience within ourselves, and more systemically within Western cultures. To do so, we need to understand the self as a body. Our body and our personhood are so intimately connected that they can never be separated. We are not just a mind or brain carried around by a meat puppet of flesh and bones. Embodiment is a kind of remembering who we really are, because what we picked up along the way was disembodiment.
but disembodiment is not how we came into the world. It can't.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?